Well met, and welcome to episode 141, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December the 18th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our two-month-long discussion of Timon of Athens with a look at some videos, Timon and the BBC's Hollow Crown, as well as a money-mouthing discussion of wealth in the play. Let's start off with the video. In 1981, as part of the third season of its Collected Works series, the BBC tackled one of only five plays that hadn't been produced by the network before this project, Timon of Athens. Now, Michael Bogdanov had been tapped to direct the play, but the BBC, being the Beeb, nixed his modern dress concept, so he quit, and new series producer Jonathan Miller, who had been prepping his own Troilus and Cressida, filled in. Now, I don't know what Bogdanov was thinking. As we've seen with, 30 plays now? The overriding production concept was neo-Elizabethan presentation, and that's what Miller gives us. He also gives us a fairly severely trimmed script, especially in the static second half. Now, if you were expecting some kind of middle-aged, pompous Timon, and after seeing the incredibly spry 72-year-old Anthony Heald in the OSF production earlier this year, I kinda was, you'd be sorely disappointed. Here we have Jonathan Pryce, then a youthful 34, as a young and thoughtful Timon. In the long first scene, we find him dealing with not even starving artists and an old Apamantus. Timon plays to this crowd when negotiating with the old man, whose daughter is being courted by Timon's servant. They applaud his resolution despite the old man's obvious displeasure. Making the opening scene seem longer is Miller's decision to make Act 1 scenes 1 and 2 the same sequence. The feast begins immediately. The characterizations revealed in these two scenes are interesting. Norman Rodway's Apamantus is annoying. His tablemates ignore him, prompting him to rail even more. Price's Timon is socially awkward, almost shy. It's almost as if his generosity is an insecure attempt to buy friends. The Flavius here is a stern butler, not some comforting servant. Timon, in this interpretation, is less sure of his friends. Miller shoots those friend request scenes in a deep focus, with much of the action happening far away, with the dialogue almost unheard. Timon's reaction at the time of the final feast is more measured, less frantic, less railing, at least to the final couplet. And according to accounts, Price improvised the reaction during the shooting, as he never quite got it right or to his satisfaction during the rehearsal process. Now, the transition to the second half is bizarrely high contrast blood of color. It's not the only thing that bleeds. It's almost as if Miller loses interest in the play here. He skips Act 4, Scenes 1 and 2, and later Act 5, Scenes 2 and 3. And it's in this last half that we find Miller's connection to his originally scheduled Troilus and Cressida. The ruins of Troy he would use in that production make an appearance in the wasteland that Timon inhabits. Even here, Timon's no crazed ranter and raver, and though many see a link between Timon and Lear, this Timon is more of an Edgar. He's static, more pathetic. He ends up burying himself as Flavius, for some inexplicable reason, joins the army. Now, it's these what-the-hell moments that hurt the production as a whole. But being this is the only game in town, there are no other video versions I've found, you should probably take time to check it out if you want to see a production. Just do not expect to love it. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are that not only did you know about, but you probably watched last Sunday's PBS Great Performances broadcast of the first part of the BBC's second season of The Hollow Crown, their conflation of the history plays, and I'd love to get your take on the production. Here's mine. It was good. Not great, mind you, but very good. As they were cutting the first play and a half of the Henry VI trilogy to fit a two-hour expanse of time, things are going to get lost. On the plus side, the show moves quickly. On the minus, we lose almost all of the Joan of Arc content. Choices had to be made, and we only see France when there are English there to see it, and we'd even lose some of those scenes. Now, given that both the Joan and Gloucester's wife witch storylines are in this half of the Henry VI plays, it would have been nice to have Joan's story fleshed out a bit. But without it, like I said, the show moves quickly. One more thing about the cuts. Well, not so much the cuts, but a major substitution. In the plays, it's Suffolk who is Margaret's paramour. Here, director Dominic Cook has decided instead to have Somerset play that role. And honestly, I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because Somerset has that early big speech in the garden plucking the red rose for Lancaster. Then we get the juxtaposition of the scenes where York captures Joan and Somerset gets Margaret, but that could have just easily been accomplished with Suffolk. So the traditionalists probably cringed at that. They probably cried foul at the casting of Sophie Okonedo as Margaret. Okonedo is black. And I have no problem with that myself, especially since she absolutely kills in the role. But I can see some balking. As will some with the sex scenes. Sex scenes, you ask. Yes, we get to see Margaret and Somerset, do the deed, something that's only hinted at in the text. You know, a little iconoclasm plus a little sex, and you've created something right in my wheelhouse. So, like I said, this is good. It's just not great. And it's not Cook's or the cast's fault. That lies with Shakespeare and Marlowe. The play just isn't that good. The speeches lack, for most part, definition, and the structure and pacing is clunky in the source material. But it is worth a viewing, especially for the final shot. York has come home and he greets his sons, Edward, George, Edmund, who we all see. And then he calls out for Richard, and we see him coming down a dark hallway in silhouette, hunchbacked with a limp, his arms swinging wildly. The shadow comes to us until it fills the screen with black. End of program. Very effective. Now, this is available on the PBS.org site, so check it out. The other episodes will run tonight and next Sunday. Yay, we get Richard for Christmas. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger, poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website. Alrighty then. When I only knew the synopsis of this play, I thought its main theme was misanthropy, and the Ashland OSF production earlier this year had that in spades. But the more I read it, the more I got a different vibe. I'm now thinking that this play is about wealth. Now, we certainly run the gamut of how to acquire said filthy lucre in this play. Earning. Flavius the steward and the other servants have traded their service for pay. Alcibiades' companions say that they will do anything for gold. Finding. Timon in Act 4, Scene 3, while digging for roots to eat, finds gold. What's here? Gold? Yellow, glittering, precious gold. Inheriting. The recently enfranchised Ventidius lately buried his father, by whose death he's steeped into a great estate. Dowry and bride price. The opening scene presents the financial transaction within a marriage. The old man describes the dowry his daughter brings to the contract, 3 talents on the present, in future all. He feels that Lucilius is not worth e of his daughter until Timon promises to counterpoise and make Lucilius weigh with her with an appropriate bride price. Receiving, as a gift. Do I really need to offer examples? I mean, really? Borrowing. We learn from the senator in Act 2, Scene 1, that Timon has borrowed at least 25,000 talents from the senator, Varro, and Isidore. Then there's owing, repayment, and interest. Ventidius, upon his return from jail, offers to return those talents. Later, in one of his rants, Timon speaks of a usurer, one that not only lends but charges outrageous interest upon return. Stealing. Despite their denial of being thieves, Timon's Act 4, Scene 3 visitors are listed as banditti, and the stage direction calls them singular bandits. In fact, it seems that the play covers all the monetary bases save maybe one, conquest. Timon tells Alcibiades, "Thou art a soldier and therefore seldom rich. A soldier may turn or be forced to thieve, as it seems with the banditti, as his wages are not high. And the victorious general would need to pay those soldiers, so any fortune won would be quickly dispersed. So how did Timon get his wealth? Well, maybe Timon had been a successful, victorious general who quit the field after paying his soldiers one last paycheck and kept a bigger payday for himself. And if the play is about wealth, then what is the value of money within the play? Well, the answer to that question is somewhat confusing, as it seems the playwright or playwrights may have been confused as well. So let's take a look at the three denominations of money that are mentioned in the play. The talent was a measure of precious metal. For the Greeks, a talent was approximately 57 pounds, 56.87 to be exact, in silver. Given a November 2016 valuation of silver, $16.55 an ounce, a talent would be worth just over $15,000. Now, Shakespeare's solidaire, or maybe it's solidary, Shakespeare's solidaire is most likely a bastardization of the Roman solidus. When in the 8th century, Pepin the Short reformed currency, a solidus was most widely valued at a shilling. There are 20 shillings in a pound. Given a November 16 exchange rate of 1 pound to $1.25, a solidus then would be worth 6 cents. Now, the English crown was worth 5 shillings. Given that same exchange rate, a crown would be worth around 30 cents. So let the confusion begin. Greek talent, Roman solidaire, English crown. Yeah, that's not going to muddy the waters at all. So let's take a look at how these denominations are used. In Act 1, Scene 1, we learn that Ventidius has been jailed for being 5 talents in debt, owing roughly $75,000. In the same scene, the old man can provide a dowry of 3 talents, roughly $45,000, which Timon promises to match. In Act 2, Scene 1, the senator claims that Timon owes to various lenders 5 and 20,000. But 25,000 what? It's not directly stated. If it's talents, that's $375 million. If it's solidaire, then it's only $1,500. Crowns, $7,500. If Ventidius was jailed for a $75,000 debt, then what's Timon doing walking around when he's over a third of a billion in a hole? But on the other hand, if he's only in debt $7,500, how could the value of all his possessions lack a half to pay his present debt? Plus, then, why would he call for talents from his friends? So the senator must be talking about talents. Okay, so Timon owes at the very least $375 million, and his current estate and movables total around $180 million. It's easy to see how he appears so prosperous. The proceeding, though, is but prelude to the real confusion. To Lucius, Lucullus, and Sempronius, Timon sends a request for 50 talents each, or a total of $225,000. It's a pretty large sum, but still a drop in the bucket of his debt. Of the senators, he wants the servants to request 1,000 talents, or $1.5 million. That's not pocket change either, but it's still a pittance against his loans. And of Ventidius, he calls for 5 talents, or $7,500. Question. If Timon only requests what he himself paid to free Ventidius, then what have his gifts been to Lucius, Lucullus, and Sempronius? In Act 3, Scene 1, we see Timon's servant, Flamius, make the request of 50 talents to Lucullus. The request is refused, but to keep the refusal silent, Lucullus offers Flamius 3 solidaires, or 18 cents. You can understand why Flamius throws the sum back at him. In the next scene, when the three strangers and Lucius discuss the request made of Lucullus, the second stranger uses the phrase, "so many talents," instead of the more specific and correct 50 talents. And Lucius uses the same, "so many talents," when responding. When Timon's servant Servilius arrives, even he uses "so many talents." Has Servilius overheard this usage and then uses it himself, maybe even mockingly? It's definitely possible, as Servilius's entrance is immediately after Lucius uses the phrase. But when Lucius responds to Servilius, he says, and this is where it gets confusing, 3 different things, depending on which version you're reading. The printed texts of the first folio, and thus both MIT's Moby Complete Shakespeare and Open Source Shakespeare, say 50 5 100 talents, which gets repunctuated in the Folger Digital Text Edition as 50 5 100 talents, thus clarifying but not really changing the amount. But as longtime readers know, I'm using the Pelican Shakespeare, with Timon of Athens being edited by Francis E. Dolan. And here, the phrase is re-punctuated as 50 m-500 m-talents. Now, it's Dolan's contention that so many talents was kind of a printer's placeholder for the correct sum of 50 talents, which is certainly what the editors of the Folger digital text have done, though so many talents appears in the Folio, Moby, and open source versions. Ms. Dolan further contends that the double-dashed punctuation of 50 m-5 100 m-talents reflects the confusion on the part of either the author or the printers over the correct amount, i.e., is it 50 or is it 500? It's pretty clear that the amount should be 50. So why the confusion on the part of the printer? We don't know. But I'm willing to argue that the 500 used by Lucius is for the benefit of his audience, to make himself look either more prosperous or more righteous in his denial. This would explain Servilius's initial response, but in the meantime, he wants less, my lord. Emphasis mine. A kind of face-saving playing along by the servant. But it doesn't get any less confusing from there. Two scenes later, when the servants of some of Timon's creditors show up at his home, we hear from Varro's servant that Timon owes Varro 3,000 crowns, and Lucius' servant responds that Timon owes Lucius another 5,000. Due to the juxtaposition of the two lines, I think it's safe to assume that Lucius' servant is talking about 5,000 crowns, or a total of $1,500. Only, this doesn't mesh. Now before, when the senator was outlining Timon's debts in Act 2, Scene 1, he noted that to Varro and to Isidore, Timon owes 9,000. Now at that point in our discussion, I had, or thought I had, concluded that we were talking talents here, not crowns. Plus, if Varro and Isidore's debt combined is 9,000, then his servant's statement of 3,000 crowns might work, if Isidore's portion is 6,000 crowns. But obviously, if the senator is saying Timon owed Varro and Isidore both 9,000 each, the servant's statement of the 3,000 would just be outright wrong. Later in the scene, when Timon appears, another of the creditor's servants calls out his due, 50 talents. And we're back to talents. But no, we're not, as Lucius's servant reiterates his due of 5,000 crowns. Well, at least the amount matches his earlier statement. And as if to say, bleep this, I'm done. The only other references to denominations of money come two scenes later in the run-up to the final feast. Some of Timon's friends, that's the stage directions commentary, not mine, but my air quotes, discuss what Timon has borrowed of them, 1,000 pieces. It really does feel as if the playwrights or the printers have given up and now are just using a generic term, pieces, with no set value. And this is the last monetary denomination named in the play. What Timon finds digging for roots in Act 4, Scene 3 is simply gold. Now with this confusion, one can kind of see how some critics want to disavow Shakespeare's part in this play. And maybe they're right. Most of the confusion over denomination comes in what we now believe is the Thomas Middleton penned third act. In the first two acts, the only denomination used is talent. There is, of course, the non-denomination specific speech of the senator, but I think we can safely assume that he's talking talents there as well. But what if those aren't mistakes of carelessness, but mindful mistakes? As if to say, denominations? Amounts? It just doesn't matter. We're talking about wealth. We're talking about borrowing and gifting. We're talking about perceived ingratitude here. Now see, that's possible, I'm thinking. But what are you thinking? Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including video review, Timon of Athens, BBC 1981, Timon of Athens, The Value of Money, The Value of Money Part 2, Alcibiades' Econ Lecture, A Tale of Two Epitaphs, Doggone of Cynics and Misanthropes, A Prayer in the Dog Pound, A Prayer to Dogs, Speech Study, Timon's Torrent of Rage, Much Ado About Dramaturgy and Older Brothers, Speech Study, Timon's Act 4, Scene 3 Opening, Hamlet and the Yellow Birds, Stage Direction and Dialogue, and the Misanthrope Cynic Exchange. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. But remember, those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Plus, if you ever have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December the 18th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.